This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Hughes, has been described in The New Yorker as the most famous art critic in the world. He's the art critic for Time magazine and reached a TV audience through his PBS series about modern art called The Shock of the New. He's commented on the so-called culture wars, criticizing both political correctness and patriotic correctness. Now he has a new book on the history of American art called American Visions. It's a companion to his new PBS series, which begins May 28th. Hughes first learned about American art from afar. He grew up in Australia and remains an Australian citizen, although he's lived in the States for over 25 years. One of the great paradoxes he's found in American art is that although he considers America the most religious country in the developed world, America has never produced great religious art. He traces that back to the Puritans.
Puritans didn't like religious iconography. They were great believers in the word, but not in the image. You know, their source of aesthetic delight and of the fountain of truth, as far as they were concerned, was the word. But anything that resembled a religious image, you know, of God or the saints or whatever, smacked to them of Rome, of Catholicism, which they loathed above all else and thought diabolic. And they associated religious painting or religious sculpture with idolatry. And what came out of it was a kind of free-floating suspicion of the usefulness of art at all. You know, art thereafter often, and during the 19th century in particular, had to justify itself to an American audience in terms of ideas about uplift and morality and self-improvement, which all lay at the heart of the origins of the American Museum. But, you know, people in America did not take very kindly to the idea that art should just be there in order to be enjoyable, you know, that it should provide an educated pleasure of the senses or whatever. See, this fancy that art is morally improving still, you know, actually I think haunts American reactions to works of art, and you see it, you know, come out in a particularly vehement form in all the, you know, the NEA controversies in recent years. If it ain't morally improving, then how can it be art, you know?
Well, how do you think the American Museum was different than the European Museum?
Well, first of all, the American Museum is not a kind of depository of plunder. There were no royal collections or ducal collections to pour into the American Museum and make public. Everything that came to the United States had to be brought here, and it was brought here quite late. I mean, serious museum collecting of art in America did not really begin until the 1870s, 1880s. And it began because there was this enormous wealth which had been generated after the Civil War, and a lot of squillionaires, topped off by the prodigious presence of J.P. Morgan, but including people like Frick and Isabella Stewart Gardner. And they really wanted to improve themselves and improve themselves in the eyes of others by buying the Renaissance. There was all this stuff available. And they bought in huge quantities in such a way that actually, you know, if you want to study the Italian Renaissance now, you really have to come to America to do it, as well as go to other places. So these, they began as essentially private museums. They were never state museums, although this came later with things like the National Gallery. And so the whole background to American collecting was quite different to what it had been in Europe.
So American collecting was generated more by self-made millionaires and businessmen than a royal court or the church or the state.
Absolutely, yeah.
So tell me more about where you think the notion of art as self-improvement enters into America in a way that's different from Europe.
Well, people placed a great emphasis on it in America because of their evangelical background. You know, that was the way in which art, which was somewhat suspected by earlier generations, was allowed to go public. It was thought that it would, morally improve people, that being exposed to the true, the good, and the beautiful was going to repaper your soul, as it were. And of course, we know, we would like to believe this, but we know in our heart of hearts that it just ain't true. I mean, the Rothko on the wall does not turn the corporate tycoon from a saber-toothed tiger into Bambi. It just doesn't do that. I mean, art can do a lot of things. It can make you more responsive to your surroundings. It can make you think and feel a bit more clearly and, you know, precisely. It can, above all, it can give you pleasure, but it doesn't actually make you a morally better person. But this was one of the great delusions of the time, and it was a fruitful delusion because it, you know, an enormous amount of accumulation of really superb objects was raised on it.
And Europeans never bought into that idea?
Not really. Ruskin did to some degree, but there wasn't anything like the same strength of belief in that idea. See, America never... it's an odd thing about American art. It never really produced much in the way of the of art which was intended as a sort of self-delighting, educated pleasure of the senses. I mean, there's no American equivalent to Henri Matisse, for instance.
So where does American art begin for you, art that you consider truly American and not a European-made art, made by a European who came to America?
The first art that really starts to look independent in America isn't painting, it isn't sculpture, it's furniture. And you know why? It's because there was that limitless supply of really fine hardwoods, so that instead, for instance, yeah, I mean, American furniture makers would follow Chippendale or Sheraton pattern books. They used them. But the thing is that if you're making a cabriole leg, you know, one of those curvy legs, and you hogged out the basic form from a 4x4 piece of mahogany, you'd get a certain amount of curvature, right? But if you have an 8x8 slab of mahogany, and, you know, it's that much deeper and wider, then you can cut into the space much more. You can produce much more extravagant kind of effects, as in the great, you know, there are these wonderful shell desks and cabinets that were made by a firm called Townsend and Goddard in Newport in the late 18th century. And they're incredibly generous and robust in their proportions, and they have this beautiful deep carving. And the and this is because you could waste so much wood, you know. And so the work begins to diverge from the English pattern books for that reason. I mean, there's nothing provincial about Philadelphia furniture by the 1760s. It's a, you know, it's an autonomous set of designs.
When I was reading what you wrote about colonial furniture in America, I was wondering, did you already know this when you started?
No, I didn't know all of it.
Did you follow American furniture before that?
Well, I'm a carpenter, you see.
I've
got I've got my own workshop out in Shelter Island where I live, and I love, you know, fiddling around in the shop, and so I am sort of interested in that stuff. You see, I don't take the view that, you know, you've got a gradation between high arts and low, with furniture somewhere at the bottom of the heap and painting up the top. I mean, you know, if you learn how to read a, you know, a really fine or even a crude chest of drawers, it may surrender up as much in terms of social understanding and, you know, give you nearly as much aesthetic pleasure or more in some cases than a painting, you know.
You describe the early American landscape painters as having a very important role in the development
indeed.
Of early art in America. What is the importance of their plays?
Well, I'll tell you. It's because, I mean, as we were talking about earlier, there was no doctrinal religious painting of any substance in America. I mean, the only, you know, religious art that you get, you know, comes out of a Baptist and mainly a Black Baptist tradition in the South. But as for doctrinal paintings, no, suppressed by Puritanism. So the visionary urge, the religious urge, got shifted sideways and it got projected upon the landscape. Why? Because the landscape was new. There were no ruins in America. There were no picturesque works of man that you could connect with. But what America had, which Europe didn't have, was this sublime, unedited, endlessly beautiful, and a never previously painted landscape, which in the eyes of artists, some artists anyway, and preachers and so forth, mattered because it was the unedited fingerprint of God. This is how God had set down the world, and it was right there in America. I mean, it's curious, you still get that kind of reaction when you go to the... Have you ever been to the Grand Canyon?
No, I wish I could say I have, but I haven't.
Well, if you do, and you talk to people as we did, you know, along, you know, doing vox pops more or less at random along the canyon rim, still you get, you know, nice pious visitors with their 5-year-old tots saying, "Oh, you know, this is wonderful because God put it in. God put this in America to let us know that we're American, and then He invented Americans so that they could look at it." You know, I mean, this was the and this is very much a kind of 19th century survival. Cole, who created the American Landscape School, this transplanted Englishman who got to New York in 1825, painted a stream of pictures in which he expressed, first of all, his anxiety about development, his anxiety about the commercialization of landscape, his desire to keep it as a perfectly unsullied Eden. And he believed that if you did keep it that way, then, you know, it would act as a kind of moral conduit, because you would see the world as God made it, as God meant it to be. Well, of course, this sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Because it's actually Cole, and then, you know, after him, Frederick Church, and writers like Thoreau and Emerson, who create this sense of the sacredness of the fragile wilderness and its ability to teach us lessons. And this then is amplified in the writings of people like John Muir, and it eventually forms the mainstream of the conservation movement. And it's still as strong, it's even stronger today than it ever was, except that it's been secularized.
My guest is art critic Robert Hughes. His new book is called American Visions. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Hughes is my guest, art critic for Time magazine, and he has a new book called American Visions, The Epic History of Art in America. And the book is a companion to the PBS TV series, which starts at the end of May. You grew up in Australia in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
When you were studying art in Australia...
I never studied art.
You never studied art?
No, there were no artistry courses available. What I did was that I studied architecture, and then I dropped out in my final year in order to write a book about art. I just learnt on the job. I started as an art critic at 21, and Australia was about the only place where somebody of my transcendent ignorance could survive as an art critic at the age of 21. And, I have no degrees except honorary ones. I never earned a real degree.
What did American art mean to you when you were starting out?
Oh, it meant freedom and freshness. But we were thinking of abstract expressionism. You know, the copy of Art News, I'm talking about the late 50s, early 60s, the copy of Art News would arrive and it would be torn to, you know, this message in a bottle from the other side of the Atlantic, and you'd tear out the 4x5-inch reproduction of the de Kooning, and you'd go home and pin it to your studio wall and then proceed to paint a purple version of it. We never got to see this stuff in the original until much later. The museums were very, very much behind the times. And the I think I'm right in saying that no work by an American abstract expressionist was really seen in Australia until at least the early 60s.
So when you were coming of age artistically, you were looking at reproductions all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We were in the postmodernist condition without knowing it. And it was a fairly weird business because, you know, passionate arguments would ensue over paintings that one had not in fact seen. That was why I decided to leave, you know. I wanted to see this stuff, and older stuff too, of course. But in a way, it was probably not unlike the situation that artists in America were like vis-a-vis Europe, you know, in the... up until at least about 1900, and as far as modern art was concerned, until the 1920s.
When you came to New York in 1970, what was happening in New York that most caught your attention?
Well, what was all around you at that time was minimalism. It was one of those, you know, from time to time the American art world has a little convulsion and it decides that something or other is dead and can never be revived. A lot of people at the time thought that painting was dead and would never be revived. So there was a lot of minimalism, there was a lot of conceptual art, there was, the beginnings, I would say, well, not the beginnings, you know, not the first faint flutterings, but a developing stream of performance and process and video art and what have you. And I must say that I've never really been interested in conceptual art. Talk about an inheritance from Puritanism and the distrust of the sensuous object. You know, a few words on the wall or a couple of stones on the floor. No, thank you. There were some extraordinary painters still walking around. Philip Guston was alive. Bob Motherwell was still alive. De Kooning was still alive, of course, although I never met him.
So but did you never believe it? Did you never believe in that era that painting was dead?
Of course not. Painting never dies. It just keeps on assuming new disguises. And painting is such a fundamental language. Fundamental in its concreteness and its flexibility and its ability to encapsulate high physical sensations, that I can't see that it would ever become useless.
Do you think painting has had to compete with television and movies and pop culture of so many different sorts, which have visual components? I mean, even rock videos have a visual component.
Sure,
you don't need to go to a museum to see something that's provocative or sensual or beautiful.
But you do need to go to a museum to see a painting,
and right.
Because you see the one claim that can be made for dear old painting is that it's got itself and itself only. That is to say, you can't get the message from reproduction, or for that matter from looking at it in one of my television programs. You can't get the full thing from there. You can't truly experience painting at second hand. The only place you can experience a sort of facsimile thing, but you can't know the real thing unless you've met it on the wall, because they are objects. They have a particular scale, a particular array of colour. They've got densities or thinnesses of opacity and depth of pigment. None of this comes across in virtual reality or on television. Only approximations of it do. There's no reason why the physicality of painting should be resented. It's certainly true that, other media are superbly good at moving huge streams and blocks of information around the board. But that, again, is not what painting is for. Painting is for delaying the eye, not making it faster.
I'm wondering if there's any one chapter within American art history that you feel you have really rewritten from the way it was perceived before?
I don't think completely rewritten. I hope that I brought some insights to an understanding of American art which maybe had not been there before, or perhaps not so clearly expressed. I would hope that. And I dare say that quite a number of my opinions will be, shrugged off or not believed, and quite rightly so too, because they might be wrong. But above all, I wanted to get away from this conventional way of thinking about American art, which was that it all came of age after the Second World War, and that what went before was embryonic or larval or merely preparatory, and then American art really grew up with the abstract expressionist. This is not so. America consistently produced extraordinary painters in the 19th and early 20th centuries. If somebody said to me, who do you prefer, Jackson Pollock or Winslow Homer, I would be unable to give you an answer, but I certainly don't think of Pollock as in any way a superior painter to Homer, not at all. Aiken's the same. Frederick Church, Frederick Church's pictures, when I first came to America in 1970, were just thought of as the height of silly bombast. Well, I think probably a few years down the line, as Church is rehabilitated, it may indeed be that people will look at Barney Newman's paintings and think they're the height of silly bombast.
Let's do an end of the millennium type of thing here. Where do you think we are now vis-a-vis American art at the end of the
millennium?
Well,
I think we're in a bit of a trough, quite frankly. I don't think that... if you look back... that's also true of art pretty much within the West. If you look back at who was walking around in Paris in 1897 and what was being made there by a whole variety of people ranging from Cézanne and Monet to Marcel Proust, and then you compare it with what is being produced in Paris right now, there isn't actually much of a comparison, in my view. And I think that we make a mistake if we imagine that cultural periods or epochs can sort of maintain their vitality right throughout. That it's a sort of parody of the old Marxian idea of permanent, refreshment by perpetual revolution. Nothing of the sort happens. Periods do, it seems, run out of steam. And I think it may be that that's what's happening now. But on the other hand, this is not a reason for, rejecting the present or anything like that. You just have to, if you do feel that the level is dropping, you don't just turn around and walk away. because there are, you know, always at any given time, some pretty good artists whom you can look at with pleasure and think about and perhaps know. And the it doesn't suddenly go from a very lively scene to being an absolutely dead, glacial scene. I mean, look, there are there are wonderful sculptors in America. Look at Richard Serra. Look at Martin Puryear. There are some very, very good painters around too. But I think the idea that America could, you know, keep on producing radically new movements with the sort of incontinent fecundity that it that it was once credited with, I think that idea has actually gone out the window, because, you know, the rise, inflation and collapse of the art market at the end of the 80s made people sceptical about that, the sort of ridiculous bombast that was associated with so many 80s artists, and the absurdly exaggerated claims that were made for them have made people nervous about claims of artistic greatness. It's a much more modest, though still overcrowded, scene now.
Robert Hughes, his new book is called American Visions. His PBS series on American art begins May 28th. Robert Hughes will be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Hughes, art critic for Time magazine. He has a new book called American Visions, which is a companion to his 8-part PBS series on the history of American art. It begins May 28th. Do you collect art?
No, I don't.
Well,
I don't.
Well, why not?
I have a few etchings. You know, I've got a few prints. My walls are not completely bare. I have a few nice sort of, you know, rather folk pottery type oldish Japanese pots and things like that. You know, there are a couple of paintings and prints that artist friends have given me in the past, but that's it. I've never collected. And I'll tell you why, because there's a conflict of interest problem, for a critic collecting the contemporary.
Oh, because then you can help make the artist's reputation and the prices would rise.
If a critic can't make a living as a writer, then he or she, and has to go into a kind of pseudo-dealership, then he or she should perhaps consider just really being a dealer and not bothering writing criticism.
Do you wish that you could surround yourself in your own home with art that you love?
Oh, of course. I'd love to have a great big Piero della Francesca on one wall and Titian's Rape of Europa on the other. Who wouldn't? But, you know, I get my pleasure from other things. There's a lot to be said for privately owning a work of art, because, you know, it enables you to see it under all sort of lights and conditions of consciousness, and you'll certainly get to understand it better than you would the same painting if you just visited it episodically in a museum. But this is a sort of trade-off, you know. I mean, like anybody else, I would love to have really fine furniture and fine ceramics and so forth, but I don't think it's imaginable that I would ever get to own the sort of things that I really most love. And so, therefore, I'm perfectly content to see them in museums.
You are an Australian-born art critic writing about American art. Do you ever feel like you have a different perspective on American art because you came here when you were already, in your 20s?
I was 32.
Oh, even older. Yeah, and you kind of like yearned for American art and, in a way, imagined American art before you actually saw the real
thing. Sort of, yes, that's right.
Do you think that you have a different perspective on American art by virtue of being somewhat of an outsider to America?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I do. But it's not just a different perspective on American art. It's, I think, probably a sort of slight shift of perspective on America as such, because all Americans, whether they want to or not, grow up with this idea of American exceptionalism, you know, that America was founded and forged for a particularly exalted destiny. You know that it, you know, the first among the nations of the world. You know, there was and this idea of exceptionalism, that it was a special case among nations, stayed absolutely solid from the time of the Puritans to the end of the Cold War, and then it began to falter. Now we Australians, on the other hand, know very well that we were not picked out for a sacred mission. We were convicts at the beginning. And so consequently, whereas Americans are continuously in a state of disappointment, we aren't.
You expect the worst.
Too much. Yeah.
I guess that leads to my last question, which is that I read that after completing the TV series, maybe you fell into a depression, and I...
Oh, horrible, yeah.
That might be too personal, I don't know, but...
No, that's okay. I don't mind talking about it. I mean, this is not Oprah Winfrey, and I don't believe in making a big point about it, but, you know, this sometimes happens in the lives of writers. We're not as tough as we imagine we are. I'd overworked. The series had really burnt me up, and then I realized that I had, you know, to finish a book more than 200,000 words long in 9 months. And it's certainly true. I rather caved in. I became reclusive, melancholic. I felt dreadful. I therefore went for the first time in my long lapsed Catholic life to see a shrink, and it did wonders.
Did it?
Yeah, it did actually. I'd never been to a shrink before. I really enjoyed it.
Talk therapy or pharmaceuticals too?
What, pills?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I had some pills too, you know, downers and, you know, the usual sort of pills to get you over the big humps. But I hated the whole thing, but it made me realize some things about myself which I know are going to be beneficial as a writer. And I'll tell you one thing that I did realize, that that agitated, depressive state is probably much more common in American life than anybody acknowledges. It's that feeling of having absolutely no safety net underneath you.
What gave you that feeling of not having a safety net?
Despair. I thought I was going to burn myself out writing the book. In practice, I didn't. But I was just terribly worried. I was anxious. I was looking over my shoulder the whole time. It was hell on my wife. But it's one of those sort of things which can be either crushing or valuable, depending of, I know this sounds like a, you know, sort of flow of therapeutic cliches, but it's one of those things that can be either crushing or valuable depending upon what you bring to it and what you bring out of it. I was very lucky in that, you know, it wasn't like being leapt upon by something incomprehensible in the dead of night. I had a fair idea what was going on. But the big problem is always to enable yourself, find a way in which you can keep working consistently through the maze of negative feeling.
When you're going through that depressed period, would art, would like going to a museum or something, temporarily get you out of it, or was that not?
Well, it wouldn't get me out of it, but I certainly still like going to museums, you know, and like Saul in his madness, I would enjoy listening to music too. You know? It isn't as if the whole world turns into shit.
That's reassuring.
Yeah, it was. Anyway.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you very much.
Robert Hughes is art critic for Time magazine. His new book, American Visions, is a companion to his PBS series on the history of American art, which begins May 28th.